Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We've got a roundtable today, but we're mixing it up a little bit. I am joined by two of the normal members of the roundtable, Jason Eisengrein, retired OIG executive, and then the retired UPIC West director, and now our special director in charge over here at Advise, Matt Kachansky, Jason's counterpart from HHS OIG, retired from there, then went on to be the Northeast UPIC director and is now a manager on our in-house SIU team. Wade McFall, who is one of our SIU team members, retired ASAC from OIG, is taking the week off for some PTO, but we've got a suitable replacement. I won't really say a replacement, but we've brought in as a special guest for this week, Lyra Andriani. You see her name is hyphenated because she is bubbly sparkling wine when she's not married. And Lyra is a member of our team. She's in the back background. You don't really hear or see a lot from Lyra, but Lyra is a member of our SIU process improvement team. She is a nurse by training, has extensive experience in the SIU, the payment integrity, and the UPIC space, and is currently working with Jason embedded in one of our larger Medicaid contract clients on an SIU process improvement project that's been going on. So, Lyra, I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute because your experience is really, you know, as I think I said this to you about a week ago, you've forgotten more than some people know. And so give everybody just the thumbnail about your background, really, and then we're going to get right into it.
Yeah, so thank you for that, Eric. So, I am a registered nurse. I do have a background as a nurse investigator. I worked on the Virginia Mpuku for several years, and then I went over to work on the Northeast UPIC. I was there on the Northeast UPIC as a medical reviewer, but also as the education and outreach coordinator. I worked with Matt Kachansky. He was my director at that time. I was there for several years. In fact, I was there for 7 years. And then I came on board with Advise, and I'm very happy to be on the Advise team. So, and doing SIU work, supporting, like you said, a large client with process improvement. I've done a lot of quality work in payment integrity as well, and I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, and it's great. It's great to have you. And you know what I will say is what people sometimes realize or don't realize is that the UPIC being the SIU for Medicare is really the tip of the spear in Medicare fraud. And Northeast UPIC, that's obviously the UPIC that was my UPIC when I was an OIG agent out of New York, is one of the larger UPICs from a volume perspective, right? Because you've got a number of strike force cities that are within that UPIC purview now, and having that responsibility of Medicare and Medicaid, and you having come from the investigators piece at the Mpuku, and then being a nurse reviewer kind of gives you this broad breath. And so, you know, one of the reasons that we asked you to come on today and talk is about, you know, we've been talking for several months about SIU and investigative process improvements, and you know, our SIUs meeting the mark from a lot of different perspectives. And lately, we've been talking a lot about this sort of 360-degree view from the payment integrity perspective, and how payment integrity really is a combination of things, including policy, investigations. It's really the full continuum of fraud, waste, and abuse. And it's not really this bifurcation that waste and abuse go to one team and fraud goes to another team. And how is, you know, there is this melding. And, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is we're really trying to get nurses to see their value from other perspectives. You know, we're doing a nurse boot camp starting in January, and it's going from January to April, where nurses that are looking to maybe make a shift in their career or expand their knowledge base by becoming certified professional coders can kind of do that. So I'm going to start with Matt. And I want to, Matt, you know, one of the things that we have known for years has been a lack of clinical documentation reviewers, and sometimes just documentation reviewers within an SIU. And we see that particularly with smaller or small to medium SIUs where they're missing that piece of the puzzle. And we see it with some of our clients where we're coming in. So let's just talk about that. Where, you know, when you have that gap, from an investigative perspective, you're missing a large portion of cases that you could be working, right?
You're missing a large portion of cases, and the cases you are working aren't as defensible, because it might be an investigator that's actually looking at medical records and making claim determinations based on what they're seeing in the medical record. And if that goes to appeals, if that is gets referred to law enforcement, that's never going to hold up. So what I see is, you know, a good SIU is like a three-legged stool: data, investigations, and clinical. And those legs of the stool are working together throughout the entire process of an SIU, from identification of problems in data analysis, where the clinicians are providing their insight to the policies and the regulations and the coding. Investigators are also providing that in the investigative process, where the clinicians have an active role in working the investigations, whether that's conducting interviews of beneficiaries or the providers with the investigators, to also providing clinical insight. I see that, and then doing the medical review on investigations where they know the context of it. They understand where this case came from. They understand the facts. They were involved in some of the interviews of it, so that when they're looking at those medical records, they have the context of it. So I see them all working together. And if you're missing the clinician part of it, or you're missing an integral part of making good determinations.
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. When I was on the UPIC, we had the investigative team leaned a lot on the medical review team. A lot of times they would call, you know, I'm not sure I really understand the meaning of this code. I'm not sure I'm trying to read this policy. I'm not sure I really understand what I'm reading here. And this is where our clinical review team would add a lot of clarity and add a lot of value to understand, to explaining the clinical and explaining the coding. The investigators are very good at what they do, but, you know, you can't be an expertise in everything. And that's where the clinical and the coders really came into play. The professional coders, they actually provide a lot. They will look at the code, and they will help bring meaning and context to the data. And they will tell you, you know, who can bill that service, what kind of provider can bill that code, whether the provider's documentation is meeting the coding requirements by looking at the medical documentation. They will also check all the policies needed to bill that code. And there are a lot of policies. The policy review itself can be quite complex, because they're going to look at Social Security Act. They'll look at the CFRs, the code, federal regulation. They'll look at NCDs, then national coverage determination, the local coverage determinations, the LCDs, the NCCI edits. Then they'll look at state policies. What if it's a Medicaid? Medicaid claims. They'll look at state policies, and then they'll make a payment determination. Should the payment be allowed, denied, or maybe it should be reduced? So just the policy review can be quite complex. They'll also look at the patient's diagnosis to see, does the diagnosis support the code that was billed? And this is something we check regularly for, like, the high cost drugs, whether the patients have the corresponding diagnosis for these high cost medications that we're seeing. They'll also check to see, can certain codes be billed together? There are certain circumstances where certain codes should not be billed together. Or maybe certain codes should only be billed together if there's a certain modifier has to be present for these codes to be built together. So that's another situation that they'll
look at. I just want to interrupt you for 1 second, Lyra, because one of the things that you've been talking about, and Matt certainly brought it up as part of the three-legged stool, is you talk a lot when we've had discussions, you talk about two pieces that are really important, which you sort of touched on, which is know your data and know your policies, right? And so, right. It just kind of gets from the very from an investigative perspective, right? You've got to look at your data, understand your policies. But part of that is being able to pick up the phone and speak to somebody who has that subject matter expertise to know it, because, right, there may be some wacky carve out on something. Yes. There may be a policy that says, under 99% of the times, this is a non-payable service, but in this instance, it is. And having someone embedded in your unit to be able to be that point of contact can make a determination, help you make a determination very quickly about whether or not you have a case or not. And that's where having that auditor / coder or that clinical auditor comes into play.
Yes, absolutely. And, you might think that you have a great case because it looks this way in the data, but then you might call your nurse coder and that nurse coder may tell you, well, wait a minute, these policies allow that. And then you realize, well, this is not a good case because all of these services would be allowed. So yes, absolutely. Having that expertise is incredibly valuable.
So Jason, I'm going to go to you because you and I last week, I think it was the week before, we got into a little discussion where I said, data lies to you. And you said, well, maybe not. And I said, well, data is going to lie until you've got somebody that confirms that it's not a lie. And if you're an investigator, everything is subject to scrutiny. And the position that I took was data is not truthful until you've corroborated the truthfulness of the data. And so, to kind of parlay on what Lear is talking about, it's having that clinical or that auditing perspective on something that could go either way, maybe in that gray area, right? So how do you see that ability to disprove data lying to you? Where in that continuum does a Lyra fit into this?
Well, right at the very beginning. So I always start off by saying that there are basically three buckets of allegations that an SIU or OIG is looking at: billing for services not rendered, some sort of misrepresentation of the service, like upcoding, unbundling, or things of that nature, and then the really murky area of medical necessity. So maybe a non-clinical person or an investigator without access to clinical subject matter expertise can make a judgment that, guess what? This paraffin wax bath wasn't rendered, so it's a billing for service not rendered. You could probably get away with that. And frankly, I did for many years because the OIG didn't back in that day have access or I'll say ready access to clinical subject matter expertise. But once you're trying to get into the very important areas of the misrepresentation of service, it's going to be about, well, is this the right code for what was provided? And certainly in medical necessity, you need that clinical expertise to know, well, was this an appropriate service for this condition? Whether the benchmarks met that would allow for payment of that service? An investigator most likely not going to be able to do it. So as Matt said at the start of this, having access to that subject matter expertise is critical. And there's really two ways it's going to happen. Either one, it's a secondary resource that's available. Either you have in-house coders and or registered nurses or other types of clinicians, or you might even have investigators. And I suggest that this is something to really consider for the new age where everyone is trying to do more with less. well, maybe there's just one more hat that we all have to wear as an investigator. Maybe the investigator becomes a certified coder. And that is very possible to do. In fact, I know for a fact it's been done in SIUs. So it's something that I would suggest be considered for future staffing and whatnot. But to your point, at the very beginning, there should be at the very least what I think I would call what Lyra was talking about is a medical consult. The investigator speaks with, you know, in the investigative planning stage is speaking with the clinician to decide, well, what am I going to need to ask if I'm going to pursue this? What data is relevant to this? What information, whether it's a, you know, it's something of a hard and fast thing, like, again, you're looking for a particular device or a particular feature of the service that happened that would in fact substantiate the allegation, because otherwise you're kind of going in with one arm tied behind your back and maybe wearing a blinder if you're just going out on your own trying to determine whether or not a claim is eligible for payment.
Right. You know, and we here at Advise, so we have somebody here who was one of the CMS designated subject matter experts when it came to trials, right? So we have somebody here who was one of the UPIC's designated subject matter experts to testify, and she puts that together, right? She puts the policy, she puts the medical records together and testifies regarding policy-related matters and things of that sort. And, you know, we've done here at Advise, we've done boot camps for SIUs who want their investigators, whether they want their investigators to actually become CPCs or if they want their investigators just to have sort of that requisite knowledge to understand the code sets better. It certainly does become like a value add within that. But so we talked a little about like these medical necessity cases, and we all know that nobody likes medical necessity cases because if they go to trial, it's a battle of the experts. Yes, that, you know, that skewer is medically necessary to be put in the ear. No, it's not medically necessary or whatever it may be. But Lyra, when you look at the CMS program integrity manual, the term medical necessity is referenced in multiple chapters of the PIM. It's referenced in multiple policies. The problem is that there is no really, really clear definition, because you've got a documentation level definition or documentation related review, and then you've got a clinical review. And, you know, the example I always will give is if a patient goes to a provider and the provider bills for level 4, but the documentation really reflects a level 3, an auditor is going to say the documentation doesn't meet the medical necessity requirements for the level 4. It meets the requirements for level 3. Now, that's not saying that the patient shouldn't have had the office visit, the E&M, right? They're just saying it's not that level. Whereas the example I'll give from a clinical perspective is you go to the doctor for a sore throat and the doctor does an EKG and the EKG is documented soup to nuts and it's a well-documented medical record, but there's no clinical medical necessity for it. A coding auditor might say, hey, this meets the requirements from a documentation perspective, but a clinical auditor is going to say, no way. How do you, from your perspective, how do you work to help to reconcile some of those issues that come up between documentation medical necessity and clinical medical necessity?
That's a good question. I do my reviews because of my background. I have a tendency to do what I call fraud-focused medical reviews, more of a fraud focused medical review. So I will look for patterns. Okay. And that's how I do my reviews. I look for patterns. So I would, in that particular case, I would say, is there a pattern where every single patient, are they documenting EKGs that there's no clinical reason for an EKG, where they're
they're documenting EKGs, and there's evidence that they did the EKG, but there's no clinical indication that there is an EKG to be done. Nobody's having chest pain. Nobody's having shortness of breath. Nobody's having dizziness. There's no indication there. Then that is where I would be looking, and I would have a tendency to deny, because there I'm seeing a pattern over multiple patients, and that's how I would approach that scenario.
And
I just want to elaborate and expand on that just a little bit further. So one of the things, if you can, if you have the luxury or the benefit of having people on your staff like that, of having people that have, you know, a coding experience, clinical experience, and experience in healthcare fraud investigation or investigative background, kind of the I call it the trifecta. What's nice about people with that kind of background is that they will look at, when they do their review, they will look at it from that kind of fraud perspective. So they will look at it not just from a coding perspective and look at all those other things that I mentioned earlier, but they will look at it specifically for fraud, things like that. They will look for things like static billing, a lack of differentiation of services, everybody getting the same diagnosis, everybody getting the same services billed. They'll look for alteration and falsification of documentation. They'll look for upcoding. They'll look for unbundling of services. And they'll look for other potential red flags and other patterns. And that's what a fraud-focused medical reviewer or somebody with a background in investigation, healthcare fraud, is very good at picking up on. They're good at picking up on patterns.
I think a little bit of what you're alluding to, if I'm hearing you, a little bit of it is that at the initial vetting stages, somebody needs to make a determination based upon the allegation and the facts known. Is this a clinical issue or is this a documentation issue, right? So if it's an issue of services not rendered, is that something that's really more on the auditor level? If it's a misrepresentation of a service, right? They're billing for X, but doing Y because Y isn't covered, but X is, right? We see this a lot with the skin grafting, where they'll call it one thing, but it's really another, that you've got to work closely from the onset with your clinical investigators, people like you, to determine, is this something that requires a clinical coding eye or clinical auditing eye, or is this something that just needs an auditing eye? So that initial vetting, knowing your data, knowing your policy, knowing your allegation, are the pieces of that puzzle that help to determine whether or not, is this a Lyra issue or is this a someone else issue?
Right.
And, exactly. And that gets into the investigative planning then. Based on those determinations, you have to use the insight from the clinician to help build your investigative plan to know who to talk to, what records to get, what parts of the records to get, so that you can put together a case based on those well-formed allegations.
So that was actually what I was going to ask you about, Matt, is how does this all fit into the investigative planning continuum, right? Because if you've got this in the beginning, right, you don't formulate your investigative plan until you feel like there's a plan to be had. And part of that is you get your data, you get your policies, you do your initial vetting, you have your conversations, and then you kind of figure out where you need to go, right? So yeah, it's part of this continuum. So Lyra, I want to give you, as we kind of wrap up, I want to give you kind of the last little thought on this. And I think part of this is that plans that don't have a documentation auditor embedded or a clinical documentation auditor embedded within their payment integrity plan are potentially missing out on investigative operational wins, right? A return on investment or something like that. You know, here we do a ton of these at Advise, where we're doing these in a fractional capacity. And, you know, when we see these SIUs that are made up of three people, you know, some SIUs that we've seen, you know, I'm convinced that the SIU director, at the end of the day, they're vacuuming the carpets and throwing out the garbage and turning out the lights because they're a small plan. They wear a lot of hats and they don't necessarily have a budget to support a full-time staff. But even from a fractional perspective, you know, you can still get a return on investment. There's an efficiency that comes from having that. And you're missing, plans miss out by not having a documentation or clinical documentation arm to, as Matt calls it, the three-legged stool, right? It really becomes part and parcel to what should be part of standard operating procedure.
Well, they're missing out on the ability, I think, to zero in and focus in on cases that have value and merit and should be pursued. Okay. And also maybe cases that should be expanded. Okay. As well. They're missing out on ROI. Absolutely, ROI. They're definitely missing out on ROI. Absolutely. So those are big things. Those are protecting their programs, right? Protecting their programs. So and their members. So all of those are big considerations for any program,
right?
Any program manager that might be listening to this should really take that under consideration.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many times, and I'm sure Matt and Jason and you, we can all come up with instances where we have an allegation on something and we look at it and we find that that allegation may not be as founded as something else. And the only way to really get to the heart of that matter, maybe there's an issue involving upcoding, but that's not really as good of an allegation as when we get somebody getting into the documentation. They go, hey, by the way, they're billing for this thing, but they're really doing this thing that you wouldn't necessarily know about, right? So that interplay that comes in is really an important piece. And I do think we're speaking, when we're really speaking to our small and medium plans that are out there, I think, unfortunately, small plans in particular fall at the wayside. I've seen through some of the work that I've done over the years here and on some of my contract work on some CMS related projects where smaller plans are almost considered in a redheaded stepchild situation where they're just not given the kind of attention that they should be. You know, when you look at a small plan where it's only got two or three members of the SIU, where they don't have a big budget to do things, that they sometimes forego their ability to do something and don't think about even the fractional costs could result in exponential wins for them. And, you know, that it really does become an integral part from a policy perspective, from an investigative planning perspective, and just also from a resources perspective, that when you don't have these people embedded within your payment integrity space, that you are missing out on fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance opportunities to have a well-run payment integrity plan that works for the members and works to positively impact providers from a training education perspective, you know, on top of it, right? We've run out of time, but we didn't even talk about the fact that providing training and education to providers has an absolute positive outcome because you're going to be showing providers the things that they can do to improve their ability to get paid for the things that they do, right? That's, we can have a whole other conversation when we talk about TPE, right? Targeted probe and, and education. Those are just important pieces of the puzzle. So this can go on, Eric, for days, Eric, on end. Just, go ahead, Jason.
Just one quick value add, and really it's just something that Matt said earlier, but it's about the sustainability of the findings. So when you have that clinical piece embedded and the findings are sustained, sure, it's definitely enhancing the return on investment, but we're all concerned about provider abrasion. You know, you don't want to tick off the providers that are in your network with things that are not sustainable. And you have an excellent example that you gave privately earlier, where, frankly, you had a situation that wasn't well documented, and it resulted in a complete reversal of all the findings. And you can just imagine what that provider thinks about participating in that program going forward.
I just had one other thing to add. These things are not static, they are dynamic. And what I mean by that is the codes, the CPT codes and the HCPCS codes, they actually change every year. They get updated, some codes get added, some codes get deleted, the policies get updated. All of these things are fluid, very fluid, they change. And another good reason to have a professional coder is they are kept updated on all of the changes that happen every year. So I did want to just mention that, because we all saw all the things that happened with COVID and everything. It was so dynamic. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I mean, look, policies and procedures are living documents, no different than an effective compliance program, right? An effective compliance program is one that is updated, that's been put with the, the latest and greatest of whatever the regs are or the law is at the time. Policies and procedures should be the same. And auditors and coders are doing the same, right? It's CEUs, it's keeping abreast of the changes. And Larry, you bring up the best example, which is during COVID, how many times were modifiers changed and CPT codes changed, right? There were HCPCS codes that were added, modifiers added and changed. And, there were a couple of letter designators for modifiers for COVID. Then it became a numeric and telemedicine and the expansion of that. So yeah, these are ever-growing conversations. The take home for me is that providers are, I always say it, are a penny wise and a pound foolish, and they step over a nickel to look for a quarter that doesn't exist. I think in the SIU space, that is oftentimes the case. Oftentimes the plans aren't investing in their payment integrity the way that they sometimes should to really create return on investment. I will close with this. We have a Medicaid payer client out there. In 2023, we did a number of reviews, hundreds of reviews across a number of different lines of business and specialties. We identified an over 5,000% return on investment for what they paid us to do the clinical documentation reviews to what we identified in overpayments that will withstand scrutiny. 5,700% is, to be more precise, is what we identified. And we're still doing audits, and we may end up the year with a higher return on investment. Wow. It sounds absurd, but at the end of the day, they're paying us to do these clinical documentation reviews, and we're finding millions of dollars in overpayments in the aggregate. So there is a return on investment that you can realize on these things. And, and I'll tell you that number is, going to probably grow to a higher number. We've done the math a number of times and found that it's a real number. We saw what we were paid for the work that we did. We saw what we've identified in overpayments. Now, at the end, will they get that over $10 million? Probably not. There's going to be a negotiation and what have you. But, what we identify is what we identify. So there is certainly a value to having people embedded in your team to be able to do that. It makes your cases much stronger. It gives you a greater value to any referrals that you may make for criminal, civil, or administrative overpayment or referral for law enforcement. And it's just something that should be kind of what becomes part of any SIU's process improvement. So we can continue to talk about this forever. Lira, we're going to have you back because we do want to talk more about some of the other nuances on process improvement that are out there and talk about things like medical necessity a little bit more in depth. So there's a lot more to talk about on this. So thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, everybody.
Matt and Jason, as always, good to see you. And again, to our viewers and our listeners, thanks again for coming on and taking all of this to heart. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, you can get it in your email inbox every Friday afternoon. It comes out. Just shoot an email to us at hello@advizehealth.com. We've got a LinkedIn Live coming up. Our president, Rachel Jones, is going to be speaking with Avni Desai, the president or CEO, I forget what your title is, of Shulman & Company, which is a company that does a lot of work in the high trust and the SOC space on AI, machine learning, and its relevance in the healthcare space. So again, we've got that coming up. We've also got, and I alluded to it earlier, our RN or our nursing boot camp to take the CPC exam. That starts in January. You can find that information on our website. You can message us directly. We can give you that information. We still have some positions and slots available for that course. It starts in January. It runs through April. It is virtual but live. And you will get all of the requisite things that you need to sit for the CPC exam if you choose to do that. So there's a lot of stuff coming up. For those of you that are celebrating, some of the holidays are out there. It is Hanukkah, so I wish everybody a happy Hanukkah. Christmas is coming, so if you don't get your tree up soon, Santa won't know to come to you. So make sure you get your Santa Claus stuff going. And we'll see you next week on the next OIG Roundtable. Thanks again for coming.